Hi, I'm Toby Graham, a partner with Farrar & Co in London.
And I'm Tom MacPhail, a senior associate with Farrar & Co. And we're both in the contentious trusts and estates team.
Here today to talk about a Privy Council decision in the case of Grandview and Wong.
And probably it makes some sense to start by giving a little bit of the background.
It's about couple of trusts that have been created by two brothers who had set up a successful business in Taiwan.
And both trusts were set up at the same time in 2001. There was a trust called the Wang Family Trust, which was a purpose trust, and there was the trust we're interested in, or more interested in here, which was a private trust, the Global Resources Trust.
Which had as its beneficiaries members of the founders' families. They were named as objects of powers of appointment, and they were also included in the default trust.
And what gave rise to the litigation was a decision taken by the GRT, the Global Resources Trust trustee, in 2005, which followed a decision from the founders to retain their personal shareholdings in FPG.
And the decision that they took was that they would remove the family members from the class of objects of the GRT and add as a new beneficiary the Wang Family Trust.
And the power that they were using to do this was a power in Clause 8 of the trust instrument, which was drafted very broadly and on its face gave the trustee the power to add any person or class or description of persons as a beneficiary. But there was a debate about whether that power could be exercised entirely freely or whether there was effectively a limitation on how it could be exercised. And that's where the proper purposes rule comes in.
And this is distinct from the concept of an excessive exercise of a power, which means going beyond the four corners of the power and doing something that is not, as a matter of its interpretation, permitted.
Yeah, so I mean, shall we dive right in? I mean, I have to say, I had the experience of when I was reading the Privy Council's decision, as I went along, I felt more and more strongly that they had got it wrong, effectively, and that the on this essential point, and that the Bermuda Court of Appeal had got it right. I think the reason I felt that was that the starting point, as the Bermuda Court of Appeal suggested, must be the wording of the clause itself. And the wording here was both very broad and plain. And there's some useful guidance in Lewin on the interpretation of settlements, which suggests that where words have an ordinary meaning, that ordinary meaning should be applied, but that it can be departed from if it's clear that that ordinary meaning doesn't reflect the purpose. But it seems to me that that's quite a high bar to get over, actually, or ought to be, perhaps. And while the and I felt that the reasons given for the Court of Appeal's decision were very concrete, and by contrast, the Privy Council's decision seems to be much more impressionistic, trying to gauge or get an overall view of what the trust is for. And I mean, certainly that gives more scope to courts, but I worry that it creates a nightmare for practitioners.
Yeah, the essential question that divided the Court of Appeal and the Privy Council was the character of the Global Resources Trust. The Privy Council concluded that it had a family character, and that conclusion derived from the beneficiaries named in the instrument, the fact that certain provisions contemplated there being individual beneficiaries, and importantly, the fact that at these two trusts were at the same time created, one for non-charitable purposes, and the other to benefit members of the family. That said, the Privy Council meant that the purpose of the wide power in Clause 8 must necessarily be consistent with that family character.
Yeah, I think there are some interesting points here. I mean, one is to what extent your views about the broad characterization of a trust should override or be able to influence the interpretation of a quite plainly drafted clause. I think it's worth saying that this was, of course, a professionally drafted instrument. It's not something the settlor had knocked up in his garden shed. It's said in the judgment that it was the product of many months of discussions involving New York and Bermuda lawyers. And it's also was submitted on behalf of the appellants, in fact, that real thought had been given to who was to benefit. But that, it seems to me, is quite a double-edged sword for the appellants, because it doesn't seem obvious that you can say that very great thought was given to who was to benefit when it comes to one part of the instrument, Schedule 3, but that the same level of care was not taken when drafting Clause 8.
Yeah, what you're, I think, identifying is an evidential issue. It's difficult to discern what the purpose for Clause 8 might have been, but that isn't, in my view, a good enough reason for effectively discarding the proper purpose rule, which would be the result of looking simply at the plain words of Clause 8.
Oh, I think that goes too far. I don't think you're discarding the proper purpose rule. I think you're what you're really saying is that when a clause is drafted broadly and using plain language, that the starting point for one should be that wording, and secondly, that the application of the proper purposes rule is arguably more confined. I don't think you're saying that it ceases to exist if you have a broadly drafted clause.
Yeah, sure. I think what we need to reflect on is whether this is a case that is confined to the slightly unusual circumstances in terms of these trusts, or whether it's one that's going to be of wider application.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think the sense that I've got from people's reaction to this is that this is likely to be widely applied. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I that's my thought too. And I'm pleased if that's the case, because I think that otherwise trustees will be in a position where they can exercise these incredibly broad powers in whatever way they please, and those that would expect to benefit from their exercise have very little comeback.
I mean, again, I think I disagree. It's not like if you don't have the proper purposes rule, then there's no effective means of controlling trustee decision making. You can, if a trustee makes a decision that's obviously mad, or indeed if a trustee blindly follows the wishes of a settlor and hasn't given proper consideration to a decision, then of course you can challenge that, and it may well be that the decision is taken in breach of trust. I don't think you need the proper purposes rule. It's meant to be a sort of safeguard, really, I think, rather than a principal weapon.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a problem with the vogue for very broad powers, and great, they give flexibility and allow for unforeseen circumstances that might evolve, but they also create ambiguity, and they potentially create the extreme right to power of the trustee to do literally whatever the trustee chooses. That can't be what anybody sane would want. And it is good that equity has fashioned some limit to that. Let's talk about how you go about working out what the purpose of a power should be.
Yes, well, I mean, I think one of the debates is whether the inquiry, well, I suppose partly where the inquiry should start and what weight should be given to the simple wording of the power you're trying to analyze. But another question is what the scope is of the material that you can consider when determining what the purpose is. And there was some difference, again, between the Court of Appeal and the Privy Council, although I suspect I'm rather more in line with you on this question. There was a particular debate about whether letters of wishes could be taken into account, wasn't there?
Yeah, so I think the Court of Appeal's view was, well, they both took the view that letters of wishes could in principle be taken into account as part of the extrinsic evidence, so you're not confined just to the four corners of the instrument. The question that Tom's alluding to is the relevance and admissibility of letters of wishes authored other than at the time that the trust was drafted, created and executed. He, Court of Appeal, said, oh, well, any letter of wishes in principle is admissible in this inquiry. The Privy Council thought that went too wide and that it was really just a letter of wishes that's contemporaneous with the execution of the trust instrument.
Yeah, and I suspect you'd say that's right, and I'd say that's right as well. That,
yeah.
Otherwise, I agree, you have a real risk of repurposing that a set law by, you know, if too great a weight is placed on letters of wishes, and particularly later letters of wishes, then that does raise the very real prospect of a set law seeking to repurpose.
By which we mean, say, the trust was set up in order to benefit the settlor's wife and three children, and 10 years later he decided he didn't like them as much as he had done, and wanted, in fact, to benefit somebody completely different. You just issue a new letter of wishes, and the purposes of that trust would then change. That isn't how it works, because the courts are really using the sort of ordinary canons of construction developed in contractual interpretation cases, and they're looking at extrinsic material that existed at the time in order to work out what people's intentions at the time were, not how they might have changed subsequently.
And I think that inquiry has the potential to be broader in the case of a discretionary trust. And I think this would play into part of what would be a concern of mine about how applicable this aspect of the proper purposes rule is to discretionary trust. It seems to be much more naturally or easily applicable to, say, a unit trust or a pension scheme, where the purpose is very clearly defined. And so you wouldn't then need to look at a broad range of materials to try to determine that. Whereas I think in a discretionary trust, it is often, there is more ambiguity. And I think you might end up having to undertake a much broader inquiry.
Yeah, I think letters of wishes rarely spell out what a settlor's purposes for the trust are in a great degree of clarity. And
sometimes they're inconsistent with the terms of the trust instrument, of course.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if they're inconsistent, then it's hard to see how they can be admissible in the inquiry. Presumably, the trust instrument is going to trump an inconsistent letter of wishes.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. Yeah.
So you're positing that the purposes haven't actually been spelled out in the letter of wishes. I suppose the takeaway then is draftsmen need to take more care in preparing the letter of wishes.
Well, I think that's right. And I think it's not limited to the letter of wishes, actually. I think this decision does potentially put the bring the proper purposes rule much more to the forefront. And I think one result is that trusts drafts people are going to need much greater care when drafting trust powers. And it may well be sensible to include some wording, or try to include some wording, in a power such as the Clause 8 power, to give an indication of the way in which it's intended that it should be used.
And recitals in trust instruments, yeah. That's going to be important. On letters of wishes, of course, is the rule that was applied in Breakspeare, that they are to be treated as part of the trustee's confidential decision making. Do Do you think that's going to be affected in relation to the contemporaneous letter of wishes by this?
I mean, I think it probably puts that rule under more pressure, certainly, because if there is more regularly going to be an inquiry of this sort, then beneficiaries are going to want to understand why the trustee is taking its decision, and if it's done that as a result in part of conducting an investigation or a sort of analysis of extrinsic material, which includes a contemporaneous letter of wishes, then it's I think it's going to be rather more difficult for a trustee to rely on that.
Yeah, I agree. So if they are claiming a particular purpose for a power as a reason for doing something, then to understand the reason for that limiting purpose, one would have thought needs to be made known to the beneficiaries so they can understand the way things have been done.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, well, I think this is a decision with the potential to be very far-reaching and to be much talked about for many months or years to come.
I agree, and I think it's going to encourage perhaps some changes in practice, which may take a little while to filter through. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, good. Well, nice chatting with you, Tom.
Likewise, Davey.